Hocus Pocus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that this is the first week of KABU's Winter Pledge Drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $15,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. When it comes to tackling the climate crisis, there are already plenty of reasons for Oregonians to take pride in our state. Earlier this year, the legislature passed three clean energy bills focused on energy affordability and climate-smart housing. In 2018, Portland also passed the first municipal clean energy fund in the United States. But unfortunately, the Oregon Treasury refuses to divest from $130 billion of the state's investment portfolio that is invested in oil, gas, and coal companies responsible for our climate emergency. Today, we talk with two members of Divest Oregon, Susan Palmiter and David Labby, about the Treasury transparency bill in front of the Oregon legislature this month, which would require Oregon to disclose and divest from fossil fuels. Susan and David, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Thanks for having us
today. Thank you so much.
Well, just before we started recording, we were talking about Oregon's wonderful reputation as a leader in environmental issues and lots of other things. And yet there are these seamy undersides of Oregon's history and present that are things that we tend to ignore. So I wanted to set our conversation today about Oregon's fossil fuel investments in the context of how Oregon is seen as this great leader in environmental issues and the contradictions that you see. So Susan, why don't you start?
Thank you for having us. Yeah, I represent, I'm one of the co-leads of the Divest Oregon campaign. It's the name of the whole campaign is Divest Oregon, Reinvest in a Fossil-Free Future. And we are looking at the piece of Oregon that is still heavily invested in fossil fuels, and that's the Oregon Treasury. The $140 billion in the Treasury, and a certain percentage still to be determined is invested in fossil fuels. And so it's billions of dollars that are invested in something that we don't think lines up with the values of most Oregonians.
Now, there's a big movement across the country and across the world to divest of fossil fuels, and a lot of colleges are doing that, a lot of organizations are doing that. Where does the state in general, both on the city level and in the private sector or in the, say, the civic sector, how are they doing in terms of divesting?
Right. So just a little bit of background on me. My background is I'm a volunteer with Divest Oregon. My background is in healthcare, but I am a PERS retiree. So I got interested in this because it's my retirement. A lot of that $140 billion that Sue was talking about, close to $100 billion of it is actually in PERS. And so a lot of this has to do with the future of the retirees who have worked for the state and public institutions and the future of the communities where they live, really. So that's just sort of my background. I've actually learned a lot about Oregon and its history, looking into the divestment story, as well as just learning sort of how the political process works. The background on divestment actually starts in around 2011, as you said, in college campuses. I think it was Swarthmore that started it off. I think it was Hampshire College that was the first college. And so there was a bunch of colleges. It was a student movement early on, really. Bill McKibben, one of the founders of the divest movement, wrote something called Do the Math, which appeared in Rolling Stone, which catalyzed a lot more of student activism, which was great. But following the student movement, there was a lot of interest among students, including in Oregon. And actually Eugene, Oregon, as you might expect, given that it has a lot of student populations, was one of the first places to divest. But the other big chunk that came along after 2011 was the faith communities. Lots of churches got involved after the students and the colleges got involved, the faith movement got involved, and then it sort of started moving on to the philanthropic community. So it's really grown. And if you looked at a chart that showed the divestment movement over time, you'd see that it sort of goes along until around the last 3 or 4 years, and then it just suddenly takes off. Because from being a student movement, it actually became a financial movement. And so we have huge, huge organizations now divesting internationally. So there's something like $40 trillion, 1,500 institutions that are now divesting. You know, Portland, Eugene was one of the cities. Portland was is a city that early on, the 2015-16 time, got divested. City of Milwaukee is divested. Reed College is divested. Lewis and Clark is divested. I think there's a U of O foundation that's divested. So there's been a lot of movement in Oregon, but not so much at the big institutional, certainly the state level. A lot of the pension, if you looked at sort of governments, probably 10 to 12% of the total divestment community, but Oregon is sort of lagged in that. So we, you know, even though we're leaders in thinking about climate change, we're not thinking about it financially.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it is hard for people to change course. It is hard for people to think long term. I think especially people who are in the financial sector, who are so locked into a old model of return on investment. Return on investment is money. Return on investment, fiduciary responsibility is about money. It's not about the future. It's a very sort of narrow view of what fiduciary responsibility is.
And can I just add to that? Yeah, thank you, David. I think also what we're realizing is that they don't really see that the future is one where the return on investment won't be there for fossil fuels. It's quite clear that in the last 10 years, fossil fuel investments have underperformed the rest of the market. And so we make the argument both for climate, but also for the fiduciary responsibility that the Treasury does have for our PERS retirees, along with the rest of the Treasury. So it really is both, and they're having trouble really changing course from their status quo of using the same private equity managers, the same asset managers that they've been using, to look at what are the possibilities for the future. That's our assessment anyway.
I'm curious, when this is brought up in terms of the climate, we'll get to the fiduciary issues in a little bit, but in terms of the climate and in terms of Oregon staying in step with what it's espousing to do, and which it's done a pretty good job in the last couple of years. I mean, one of my biggest thrills was when the state regulatory agency started denying permits to the Jordan Cove LNG facility, which took a long time and took a lot of pressure, but it happened. How that connect doesn't happen with the Treasury Department.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that the Treasury is really kept pretty separate from the rest of what we talk about. And I think part of it is just shining a light on what's going on with the Treasury. I think we have done a great job at looking at shutting down Zenith and Jordan Cove and other infrastructure projects, but we're not looking upstream to who's funding that. And that's really where, that's how I got into the movement, is that we can do all of that work, you know, once the money's there and the insurance companies are on board. But if we go upstream and say, who's funding that? Who's giving those monies to develop those projects? That's where the real leverage is. And that's where we can move the ships quickly, because we know we only have 8 or 9 years to move quickly. And these big pots of money, like $140 billion, is where you start having some leverage.
Well, what's been interesting to me is seeing the environmental movement going after banks and other big financial agencies and getting them to divest from pipelines and from other fossil fuel projects. Is there a model that you can use? Before we get to that, I'm just wondering, what's the difference between that happening and what you want to see happen at the state treasury level?
There isn't a lot of difference, really. We're part of the Stop the Money Pipeline coalition. It's a national coalition of folks that are working on all kinds of asset managers, whether that's banks, insurance companies, or institutional investors like the Treasury. So really, it's all under that same umbrella of looking where the money is, looking how people are insuring, and trying to stop that pipeline of money.
So when you start looking behind the curtain in the Treasury here, What are you starting to see? Or are you able to even look behind the curtain?
Well, we did do a public records request, and we have the data. So we're beginning to sort through the data. It took longer than one would have hoped to get the data, 4 months. But we have it. There also has been stand.org did an initial look at a bunch of state pensions, Oregon included, but they only had access to part of the investment portfolios. So we know that there are billions of dollars in Oregon investments that are going to fossil fuel companies, Chevron, Phillips, Conoco, Exxon. We don't know how deep that is, but we know it's there. So the question is really looking more deeply with a complete set of data, as much as we can get it, to really find out what we're investing in. But truly, it shouldn't be a bunch of volunteers like myself and Sue and others that we can corral that looks at this. It really should be the Treasury. I can tell you that my pension is based on their decision making. I would like them to think about this because we know that there's a huge risk. And I think it's one of the risk mitigation strategies they have to have is to think about what would happen as we shift alternative fuels and these become stranded assets, billions of dollars of stranded assets, and suddenly they go to nothing. So we can do it. We're looking at it, and we know it's there, but we just don't know how much is there.
Are you getting any cooperation from the Treasury in terms of helping you figure this out?
I'll respond to that. Just finding out what the investments are is difficult. It took us 4 months of weekly pressuring and a lot of public pressure to the Treasury to even get those investments disclosed. They are public record, but they really slowed down that process. We cannot find out what the investments are in their private equity holdings. We know what the funds are, but we don't know what the investments are, and that's about 25% of PERS. Oregon statute does not allow them to reveal that, and so there's a whole piece that we will not be able to understand, unfortunately, and that's part of what private equity does for asset managers is says, give us the money, we'll invest it, you don't know what's going on, and we'll invest in almost anything. And we know from the private equity stakeholder project that 80-some percent in the biggest private equity funds are fossil fuel holdings. So we know that there's probably a pretty large chunk there. It's just unclear to us. And Treasury is not sharing that with us.
Well, it's interesting to hear that this actually state regulations or state laws that prohibit Treasury from revealing this information. Where did those laws come from?
They're a law in almost every state that has any kind of public pension fund. So that's every state. They private equity firms have required asset managers like the Treasury to put statute in law so that it is held in secrecy. It's a national issue, one that we're working with the Climate Safe Pension Network to start really examining that and turning that around. We have a bill in front of the House and Senate, the short session right now, 4115, to have the Treasury disclose their investments every year. But unfortunately, because of that pre-existing statute, we will never understand the private equity issue unless that statute is overturned. And that'll be something that we would consider in the future. But with this particular short session bill, we're just asking for the Treasury to provide their investment holdings on their publicly traded investments every year, once a year. We think that's a minimal kind of ask, and we think all Oregonians should know what's in their Treasury's investments.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Susan Palmiter and David Labby with Divest Oregon about the Treasury Transparency Bill in front of the Oregon legislature this month, which would require Oregon to disclose and divest from fossil fuels. I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. So join now and help us meet our $15,000 goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO-FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. It seems like we need some more community-powered government as well. I was thinking just a few moments ago about how I think every state elected official is a Democrat now in Oregon, including the state treasurer. So why are the Democrats having such a hard time with this?
I think it's a political evolution. We have to commit as a state to really be willing to face the realities of climate change. And that means that we have to start thinking differently. And that's really hard for political institutions. There's a lot of hesitancy to sort of rock the boat. But, you know, the switch to me is once you say, look, yes, this is real. We really have to take this seriously. Then you sort of think differently. So, I mean, you even have the Pope saying, you know, people need to think about this. You have the Queen of England saying she needs to look at her investments. So it's just a mind shift. And I think it's hard across the political spectrum, even on the progressive side, for everybody to make that leap. But once you do, you see a whole different way of thinking about things. I mean, New York State, finally, after lots of struggles, got convinced that they need to look at this. And they're doing a pretty good job thinking, you know, being very transparent. They're also doing a good job of thinking about, well, how should we work with these organizations that are these companies that are fossil fuel companies? You know, should we just cut them off? Or should we say, if you're really committed to transforming, we'll stick with you. So there's lots. It's just opening up this whole new conversation rather than saying, oh, no, we can't go there. And I think that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for people to take this seriously. I mean, how many heat domes, how many droughts, how much agricultural destruction do we need before people say, you know, we really need to take this seriously?
Not to mention how many wildfires. How about our neighbors to the north and south? How are they doing with this? Talking about Washington and California.
California has had Fossil Free California, an organization similar to ours, that started many years ago, 5 to 6 years ago, and they have struggled, to be honest. There are forces in California that have really made it difficult for them. There are large, there are many different pension funds and treasury in California. Oregon is somewhat unique. We have one public employee retirement system. California has CalSTRS, CalPERS, several different public retirement systems. So they have a more difficult problem. They have lots more people to try to work with to understand the issues. We have one. We have a real advantage in Oregon because we have one treasurer, we have one Oregon Investment Council that oversees the policies for the treasury, and we have one PER system that could easily find its way towards divestment. To our north, Washington is working on this as well. We are part of this consortium of many states, and Washington is just coming to forming a similar kind of group, I think, but they're working on their city treasuries and so forth. Well, we are a little ahead of the curve on that. Or in Oregon, you know, Multnomah County and the city divested 6-7 years ago. So we are a little ahead of Washington and maybe about the same place. California's looking to us to say, you know, maybe you all be first because it's a more difficult system down there. So we're hoping to lead our side of the country. We have this wonderful network that we work with. We are part of a large national movement. We have folks even in Alaska that are working on this in a state where, you know, they are dependent on their fossil fuels for jobs and other things. We don't have that here in Oregon, so it should be a slam dunk. It should be easy.
Besides New York State, what other states back east are as far ahead as New York?
Well, Maine's even further ahead. They actually have legislation. So they are actively working with their treasurer and the person in charge of their retirement system. And they have a nice working relationship with that treasurer. And that treasurer sees the light and is making way. New Jersey as well has legislation pending currently, and they're working on that this year. Massachusetts has a similar work going on. We've got folks in Colorado, in Illinois. Really, you know, there are pockets all over the progressive country. And we're hopeful. But, you know, there are folks at ALEC and other folks that are trying to, they see divestment as a threat now. The coal and oil industries have come out saying divestment is actually hurting them. So we know it's working. And they are trying to shore up their position in states that are fossil fuel producers. So we know this is, you know, a battle that we'll have to take to every state.
For listeners who don't know what ALEC is, can you just explain who they are?
Well, I'm not sure I can give a great overview, but they are typically funding efforts to push back against the progressive movement in this country. That's a very blanket statement.
I understand they actually write model legislation for states, and a lot of that legislation has gotten passed. And I also think that they have some ties to the Koch brothers, or the remaining Koch brother.
I think they get a lot of funding from the Koch brothers, yeah.
How about Texas? Any inroads there? Speaking of a fossil fuel petrostate.
Yeah, there's a small union movement in Texas, and they actually have taken this on and done some really impressive work. So yes, there's a voice in Texas that's looking at climate change and the impact on their economy and how they're going to transform themselves over the future. How they're going to in a certain sense, they're more at risk than every place else because they're doing all the extraction. And once that gets to the point where people say, you can't do that anymore, what's their economy based on? So those are conversations that fortunately there are people there who are trying to lead. It's interesting that a lot, you know, in the beginning, all the divestment movement was actually in the U.S. Most of it was in the U.S. And now 2/3 of it's international. So there are lots of divestment movements happening in the U.K. and in Europe. The U.K. has been very progressive. I mentioned the Queen, but it's more than the Queen. It's the City of London. It's the largest pension fund plan in the UK has now decided to divest. So it has to be an international movement, and it is an international movement. So that's one of the, I think, the strengths we have going for us. A lot of that $40 trillion is out of Europe.
You mentioned that the divestment movement in Maine has a good relationship with their state treasurer. How's your relationship with our state treasurer?
I would like it to be better. We tried to have an open dialogue with our treasurer. He was great and came on a Q&A with climate justice activists back in May. And we were so happy to have a dialogue with him. And we've had a dialogue throughout. But I got to say, it's been a little rocky with this Treasury Transparency Bill that's up in the short session right now. And we are hoping that we'll come back together, because we know we need to work with the Treasury, and we know that it's to his advantage and the advantage of the Treasury. I don't want to put it on the one elected official, because, you know, he will be term limited in a couple years and there'll be that next treasurer. So we need to just have a good relationship with the Treasury and with the Oregon Investment Council. And I think they need to have a good relationship with an organization like Divest Oregon that's really trying to think about climate and the fiduciary responsibility that they have. So we're hoping that the relationship can be strong, because we think it will get a better result with a good relationship.
Well, my memory when he ran for office most recently, that he was running as a progressive. And so that's one of the things, it's one of those conundrums, is how do progressives reconcile their progressiveness, especially around climate issues, when they have such an archaic approach to how to manage money?
We were hoping you had the answer to that.
I try to put myself in the treasurer's position, and it must be difficult, because he is working with folks that have been there a long time and have done things the same way for a long time. And I know they are trying to make some movement in the right direction, but it's From our perspective, it's just not fast enough. He has been treasurer for a while now, and we feel that there's a lot of opportunity for moving faster. We cannot move slowly. We cannot do that. And they wrote a letter, the OIC and the treasurer wrote a letter to the legislature in late November saying that it was not, you know, even if they wanted to do it personally, they could not do this without a legislative mandate. We do not believe that. We actually believe there is plenty of legal standing to say that they could do this without legislative mandate, but that is why now we're over in the legislature, because they asked for legislative mandate, and if that's what's necessary, we will work that way as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this legislative mandate. I know that Con Pham, who's recently elected state rep from east side of Portland, and a couple other people sponsored the bill and wrote an excellent op-ed piece in the Oregonian, which you forwarded to me. I want to talk about, let's a little bit about where they're coming from and what is in this bill.
It's a very simple bill. It's it has two parts. One is that the Treasury has to reveal their investments once a year. And the second part is that we know that they commissioned a climate risk assessment back end of last year, and we would like to know what that risk assessment said about the climate risks to their investments. And so the second part of the bill is that they release that information to the public as well. We did amend the bill along with Treasury to protect the private equity investments, because that's already in statute, and so we couldn't overturn that statute and get that information. So it's basically just those two pieces. We have Rep. Pham, Senator Golden, Rep. Holvey, and Senator Akasha Spence-Lawrence, who is joined the chief co-sponsor. So we have very solid chief co-sponsors. And let's face it, last year we had some real wins with climate legislation, with House Bill 2021 saying we had to get 100% renewables by 2040, and other pieces that we have to get in sync with our different state agencies. The legislature's moving and the Treasury is not. And so when they realized that, they jumped on board with us and said, let's start working on this. And in a short session, really, a Treasury transparency bill was the first step of understanding what our holdings are.
How much support is there in the legislature for it?
Well, we've talked to 58 legislators out of the 90-some, and I haven't heard one of them say we don't believe in transparency. They, but in principle, all of them do on both sides of the aisle. So we have heard no opposition, honestly, to the bill, other than, you know, have to read the language and make sure that the Treasury can actually do this. But we feel like we have strong support, and both for this bill, but also for the idea of bringing the Treasury in line with the values of Oregonians.
Well, there's been a lot of opposition on the part of some of the Republican legislators about doing anything for the climate, because that's bad for business, it's bad for the economy, it's bad for the farmers, it's bad for people who drive trucks. I'm wondering if you expect to get some of the same blowback from that quarter against this bill, if they're going to recognize it as being just one more climate bill.
The Republicans we've spoken with, in principle, believe in good governance and in transparency, and that's all that this bill is. The discussion about divestment is for another day, and that may cause some concern on the other side of the aisle. We believe that the fiduciary risks of not divesting should bring along our Republican brothers and sisters, but that's for another day. This transparency bill is about good governance, and we feel like we should have full support.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Susan Palmiter and David Labby with Divest Oregon about the Treasury Transparency Bill in front of the Oregon legislature this month, which would require Oregon to disclose and divest from fossil fuels. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our current winter pledge drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of our listeners are members. Help increase our member ratio and meet our $15,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO-FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. One of the concerns that a lot of people I've talked to who are pushing various bills in the legislature during the short session is that there's so many bills, and how are they all going to get airing? And I wonder what you think your chances are. Do you see how it stacks up on the priority list?
Well, we are happy to say that we have a work session tomorrow in the Revenue Committee, and so we think we'll get voted out of the Revenue Committee and hopefully get a vote at the House level. So we're hopeful. We think this is such a simple bill, it should just kind of sail through. There's such important things being discussed in the legislature right now. I honestly just want this bill to get out of the way so the other important legislation can happen, the REACH bill and some of our other bills that are so important for resiliency around climate and for education and for healthcare. So clearly, we hope this bill passes, and we hope it doesn't take up anybody's time. We think it should just move.
And you hope that the Republicans don't decide to leave again.
I sure hope so.
Maybe you can get it voted on before they get all like testy and threaten that one.
Well, I think one of the things that this session will tell us is what the where we are at, and exactly what you were asking about. Where are we at in terms of the commitment of the legislators to actually do something around climate? I mean, this is a really, really, as Susan said, this is a really simple bill. It's just about, we need a report, right? We need you to tell us what you're already doing. It's not, there's no huge fiduciary or cost to this. So what's the commitment of the legislature to actually acting on climate? There are some really complicated things that need to happen. But this is simple, so I think this is a good test for our legislature and our legislative process, whether Oregonians can actually see that they're committed to dealing with the climate issues that are all impacting all of us.
And I would argue it's not even about climate. You know, clearly that's our motivation, but this bill has nothing to do with climate. It does ask for the climate risk assessment report, but it doesn't do anything in terms of divestment. And so I would challenge any of our legislators to just pass it on a good governance transparency basis. And that's really what it is.
You were talking about risk analysis around the fiduciary issues. I just sat in on a very interesting press conference the county did the other day about risk analysis about the big earthquake and all those tanks sitting in those tank farms on liquefaction soil in the Portland Harbor. And I think people are starting to take risk analysis a little bit more seriously, though I was sitting feeling very unnerved during the press conference because they're talking about the timeline and they're trying to get this bill passed that will then kick into effect in July, and then they'll have a report in a year. And I finally raised the question, what happens if the big one happens sooner? And I think that that's the other thing to look at. So I'm wondering how we get people to take risk analysis beyond the step of just doing the study. And is that anything that you're involved in?
Well, it's all wrapped up together, right? You've got to know what you're dealing with, and that's what the city and county did by sponsoring that research study for the Central Energy Hub, which was so critical in just understanding what it is. So really the parallel is a perfect parallel. That's what we're asking for with this first step is, what is the issue? How much are we dealing with? And then what is that next step of how to mitigate that risk? And for the Central Energy Hub is, you know, you either better mitigate it or you better have it well insured, because it's going to be horrible. 80-90% of our fuel is for the whole state is right there. So even if you don't care about what that flowing into the river, we're not going to have any fuel. So so that's a real issue over there. And same for us. If we don't understand what's there to begin with, and then what can be done to mitigate it, then we have no hope of making those changes. I really appreciate that analogy.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the risk. And maybe, David, you can continue. You've talked some about the fiduciary risks that involved. And I wanted to get that perspective that you started the show out with about being a PERS recipient. And how having your retirement funds dependent on fossil fuel investments is a real threat to your future.
Sure. I mean, I've been learning more and more about PERS financing. I can't say I'm an expert by far. It's really complicated. But the basic fact is PERS was actually doing pretty well until about the 2008 Great Recession. And then because the returns on the investments just tanked, it completely lost its full funding. And so now we have funding for, at best, 80% of the liabilities. So I was just reading an article that came out of The Guardian that referenced some research done in Nature that basically said the crisis that fossil fuels may create will look like the 2008 recession. In other words, suddenly everybody will realize they can't use these fossil fuels. They have to stay in the ground. Things have gotten so bad, we can't do this anymore. And the impact, the financial impact of that will be the same as 2008, which tanked the PERS program. So we are facing, because of the risks on fossil fuels, a huge investment issue and a huge issue risk for all of us who are retired and communities who depend on. And PERS has done a great job showing how the PERS program supports communities and how the funds flow into communities. When that stops, it's a huge crisis for Oregon. So we need to figure this out. I mean, PERS is complicated. This is only one part of the complications of all the PERS issues. But this is something simple. This we can do. We can look at our risk from these kinds of investments and mitigate it. And we know the people that pension funds that have done this have done really well. So it's not that this is going to cost us anything. I think Sue said this already. People who have divested, funds that have divested, have done better than if they hadn't divested.
A number of years ago, we had some Exxon stock, which I hate to admit, and I was a lapse of judgment for a moment. And I kept saying, I want to get rid of it. And we did get rid of it. And then shortly after that, Exxon tanked totally. I mean, it did come back up, but it dropped, I mean, like 80% or something. And I was really glad that we'd gotten out of it before we lost any money. And it was also a lesson, even though, and I guess an example of another progressive person who's not totally mindful of where her money's going. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the people who don't believe that we have to leave it in the ground ever, which is basically the fossil fuel industry. How do you counter those arguments? Because they're there. There's people who are going to say, oh, we're not going to be, we'll still be using oil in 2040.
Well, I think reality is hard to see. How many heat domes, wildfires, et cetera, do we need before people start saying, you know, this is real? And we're going to have to do it. I mean, the fossil fuel companies, the big companies, they're saying, oh, you know, we're going to be carbon neutral. But what they're really talking about is carbon capture and how they produce, not what happens to the product. So we have a long way to go. This is, you know, we are not even close to having the conversations about what this means nationally that we need to have. And my fear, you know, I'm a grandfather. I got grandkids, my fear is that we're going to wait too long to have these conversations. And the conversations won't happen until things are so dire that it really does tank the economy. And so I think we just have to keep pushing, raising the bar on what is allowable.
Well, who are some of the forces in this state that you are having to confront as you push your arguments forward?
Well, number one is the Treasury. And number two is the Oregon Investment Council that sets policy. But number three is we have folks that are PERS members. I'm from a PERS family also, and many in our coalition are. But we do have folks that aren't as versed. I think they still think that the fossil fuel industry is a good investment, and they, you know, want to make sure that those retirement funds are there for them. So, you know, I think we've got some labor unions that are still concerned for their PERS members, and we completely respect that they want to make sure that those retirement funds are there. Dave and I are good examples of that. But we have, you know, opened up that box and looked inside and said, wait a minute, is that really a good investment? And then the second piece, I just want to kind of circle back to your previous question, in that if our money keeps investing in fossil fuels, that same amount of investment could be moving us in the direction we want to be going. And if we don't start looking at what those opportunities are, because clearly the auto industry is moving quickly towards electric fleets, both trucks and airlines, everybody's looking at the electric future. And so we are missing opportunities and investments in both mirroring our own values and huge opportunities for returns on that investment.
So are you suggesting that if we don't jump in soon enough, well, that the stocks will go up in price and it's like you'll be buying high and selling low?
Yeah, that's not what you want to be doing. But I, you know, and again, I'm not an investment specialist either, but you know, what are our values as Oregonians? Are we looking towards the future or are we looking back? And that's the real question I think we have to decide. That do our financial decisions mirror our values? And I think that's a question we can take on as individuals, like you were just talking about, Barbara, and I think we should. But we also need to look as a collective and how we're doing that in the institutions that we belong to, which the Treasury is the biggest pot of money in the state, and there we need to start.
Do you see any role modeling in other sectors, other facets of political work and organizing and in the climate movement that maybe can help you, help guide your way towards this?
Well, I think the returns that people are getting from alternative energy, when we know that when people invest in the alternative energy sector, they actually do better than the market. And so I think, you know, for financial people, that's the language they speak, right? So we need to sort of highlight where people are doing over and over again that this is not craziness. This is good financial management. And there is evidence over and over again. Rockefeller Foundation found this out. You know, if they did better after they'd invested, than they would have if they'd stayed where they were. And over again, that's the kind of thing that speaks to the people who are charged with investing the money for the future of Oregon. And, you know, I'm not minimizing how complicated that job is, but we need to sort of change their mindset about it and get them to look at the opportunity that they're leaving behind by staying in the way that with their as business as usual.
Are you doing any organizing amongst PERS recipients as well to get them to help motivate the Treasury to move in a different direction?
We have a lot of folks that are PERS recipients that are part of this coalition. We're a coalition of 85 organizations around the state growing daily, and many of those organizations represent PERS members. Probably the largest is the American Federation of Teachers with their 17,000 PERS members. Those teachers out there, the ones I have talked to that have joined our group are just so disturbed and distraught that they are working with the youth of the future and their retirement funds are funding that destruction. It's a heartbreak to actually hear them speak. So I'd say yes, PERS members get it. The ones that I think have, you know, been able to see the data and also are concerned about the future of the state and the country and the world.
So do you think that that's a large percentage of PERS recipients?
The largest block of PERS members are teachers.
Teachers and professors. So we also have the AEUP, which is the university professors in the state. So the teachers and professors are on board.
And there's been a lot of movement among teachers to teach climate change. I mean, they're looking at the next generation thinking, what do these kids need to know? How are we going to arm them with the information and the skills and the knowledge they need for the future? And they're right on board. So it's, you know, the more you see it day to day, the more you look at it in the eye, I think the more you get it. So I'm hoping their example will be examples to others.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KPRU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Susan Palmiter and David Labbe with Divest Oregon about the Treasury Transparency Bill in front of the Oregon legislature this month, which would require Oregon to disclose and divest from fossil fuels. It's time once again to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO has trained thousands of people to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from members like you. So please support this vital community institution and help us meet our $15,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, in the remaining minutes, I just wanted to see what your vision is about getting the divestment going that you're thinking about, and what the reinvestment would look like, and how that could really help to shape a different future.
Well, we've left the question of reinvestment and what that looks like for another day. But I think the vision of the future is creating a coalition. I mean, that's really what I think the strength of the Divest Oregon movement has been. It is an amazing collection of, you know, unions, as we talked about, of faith organizations, of youth organizations, of environmental organizations, of progressive organizations. And so I think the future has to be from the bottom up, that we have to, as Oregonians from all across the state, in as loud a voice as we can, saying we have to take this on. It's our future. So I think that that's, and that, you know, there are a number of bills in the legislature in the short session today that sort of gets to, well, what's the next steps? How do we know where we're at? That's the kind of work that has to be done. There's no simple answer that says, well, this is what we need to do to get ourselves, this is the investments we need. But we have to be willing to have the conversation. And that's where we're at, which is, let's look at the data. Let's have the conversation. Let's stop saying this is not a problem. This is a problem. So how do we, and the more voices that say that as loudly as possible, the more chance we have of making this a critical issue. You know, the governor's race is going to be, is truly, whether they make it or they say it or not, is a race about our climate future. That's what it's about. Because that, the next governor is going to be in the hot seat, as you might say, at exactly the time that we need to make the most critical decisions for the future of this state. That's absolutely the truth. And whether or not, and we're hoping that that becomes part of that political dialogue. But we must demand as citizens that it be, because that's our future.
I was actually reading an article about, one of the latest Republicans to throw his hat in for the governor's race, and he's currently the mayor of Sandy, Oregon. And he's running on a platform of, we want, you know, healthy values like we have here in Sandy, as opposed to the degenerate Portlanders. So to me, that's a real diversion from what's going on. But I wonder, and I'm not sure how far he is in actually running, but I wonder how we keep the focus on climate as opposed to talking about vandalism in downtown Portland.
There are many important issues in our city and our state, and we can't minimize any of them. But as David said, climate's the one that's the existential issue that we need to really work on. And we invite anyone, I want to make sure to give a little plug, we invite anyone that's interested in joining us and getting more information to go to our website, divestoregon.org. There is a take action button that you can contact your legislators and let them know how you feel about this, or a join us button to join the coalition. We invite everyone. It's a big tent kind of coalition, and we invite everyone to join us.
I'll put the link on the Locus Focus website as well. I want to go jump beyond the legislative session and just sort of get a sense of where you're going to go from there, because this looks like it's still a pretty long journey, and just getting this bill passed isn't going to be the end of the project.
No, we have several avenues that we're pursuing. I don't really want to go into too much detail to show our hand, but we're taking all approaches, both legislatively, legally, in appointments, in every aspect of how the Treasury is influenced and is managed. We would really like to mostly work directly with the Treasury, but we will work every channel we can. And we've got a great team of folks, David and many others. We've got a core team of about 50 to 60 people just in our core who are working on many different aspects of this campaign. So we're not giving up, and we're going to be moving full steam ahead.
So is there any paid direction to this campaign, or is this really a grassroots volunteer effort exclusively?
It's completely grassroots. We've had a couple organizations offer grant money to us that we have accepted, one for a phone banking. We had 1,500 phone calls into the Treasury back in November, and we've had some other small grants to help just with some clerical work and so forth. But yeah, it's volunteer, it's grassroots as it comes.
And is that the plan for the future, to stay that way?
I think it will be. We may take some small donations just to be able to bring in some other voices. We have brought in some grant money that was again offered to us to bring in youth and voices that normally wouldn't be able to be heard as well in some of these spaces. So we're really glad to have a fellows program that's a lot of youth and BIPOC folks that wouldn't normally perhaps be able to get as involved. So we have a little bit of funds here and there, but we're hoping to keep it volunteer and grassroots. I think that's one of our strengths.
I think it's interesting and important that you're really reaching out to youth. And I just want to know a little bit more about that, because that seems to be really the motivation for all of this.
Absolutely. And I've got to say, just today we had a meeting this morning and one of our youth leaders said, you know, I think we need to start working on phone calls into the legislature. I'd like to write the script for that and start getting that out to everybody. And, you know, and I was like, yeah, that, wow, let's do that. And so she's leading us in great directions. And we have several of these youth leaders that are getting us familiar with TikTok and how to, you know, how to do that, and finding new ways and new approaches to reach out to youth and BIPOC members of our community. So we're super excited about just bringing in more folks and more ideas.
And David, how about you and your grandkids?
Well, my four and a half year old grandkid is not quite as a social activist quite yet. But, you know, it does, when you have a grandchild, it does change the way you think about the world. I'm sure many people know this. And so it's not just, oh, you know, I've got a great life, so be it. It's like, what's Danny's life going to be like? And it just sort of changes, you know, you think about the future, the long-term future. And it doesn't, you know, we're not really on track to being where the IPCC says we need to be. You know, we're not getting there. And, you know, many of our social institutions, social and governmental institutions, don't seem to be able to move as quickly as possible. And that's really, really, really concerning. This has got to be grassroots. This has got to be, I mean, one of the things I love about Divest Oregon is that it is such a broad coalition. It's a watering hole where many people come together. They're all involved in other things. But we're all talking about the same sort of direction. So it's great. And I think that's our future. It has to be grassroots.
Well, Susan and David, it's great to talk to you. I'm really interested in learning more about Divest Oregon. This is kind of a lot of new information for me and I'm sure for our listeners. So thanks for being on Locus Focus today.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Barbara.
We've been talking with Susan Perlmutter and David Labbe with Divest Oregon, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us during our winter pledge drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Eric Fernandez with Oregon Wild about Earl Blumenauer's legislative proposal to expand protected areas in the Mount Hood National Forest. We'll go out with Satellites by Ricky Lee Jones. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Together.